Namaste Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto. Yeah. Canto 11, Chapter 13, Text 33. Evam vimbishya gunato manasastravastha. Manmayaya mayikrita iti nischitartha. Sanchidyahard manumana sad Titikshna. Nana sina vajata mak kila sanshayadhim. Evam vimbishya gunato manasastravastha. Manmayaya mayi krita iti nischitartha. Sanchidyahard manumana sad ukti tikshna. Krana sina bhajata ma kila samsayadim. Evam vimbishya gunato manasastyavastha. Manmayaya mayi krita iti nischitartha. Sanchidyahardam anumana sad ukti tikshna. Jnana sina bhajata makila samsayadim.
Man, my, yeah, 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 my, y
Evam, thus, vimbishya, considering, gunataha, by the modes of nature, manasa, of the mind, triyavastha, the three states of consciousness, matmayaya, by the influence of my illusory potency, mayi, in me, krita, imposed, iti, thus, nischata artha, those who have ascertained the actual meaning of the soul, sanchidya, cutting off, hardam, situated in the heart, anumana, by logic, satukti, by the instructions of sages and the Vedic literatures, tikshna, sharpened, jnana, of knowledge, asina, by the sword, bhajata, all of you worship, ma, me, akhila, of all, samsaya, doubts, adhim, the cause, false ego. Translation. You should consider how, by the influence of my illusory energy, these three states of the mind, caused by the modes of nature, have been artificially imagined to exist in me. Having definitely ascertained the truth of the soul, you should utilize the sharpened sword of knowledge acquired by logical reflection and from the instructions of sages and Vedic literatures to completely cut off the false ego, which is the breeding ground of all doubts. All of you should then worship me, who am situated within the heart. Purport. My disciples of Prabhupada. One who has obtained transcendental knowledge is no longer dependent on the three stages of ordinary consciousness, namely waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep. One thus rids one's material mind of the tendency to become the enjoyer of the inferior energy of the Lord, and one sees everything as part and parcel of the Lord's potency, meant only for the enjoyment of the Lord himself. In such a state of consciousness, one naturally surrenders fully to the Lord's devotional service, which Lord Hamsa here advises the sons of Lord Brahma to take up. I lost my voice last week and I've been waiting and waiting and waiting for it to come back. I'm still waiting. But through prayers, hopefully I'll be able to say something. So this verse is a continuation of the instructions of Hamsavatar, which we've been hearing over the last few days. The four Kumaras, as we know, approached Lord Brahma with a question, and Brahma was so engrossed in the activities of creation that he was unable to ascertain the answer. So within his heart, he meditated upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead for the answer. So Krishna appeared as Hamsavatar to answer those questions, specifically about Gyan. This conversation is nested within the broader conversation of Uddhava and Krishna in the Uddhava Gita. So the majority portion of the 11th canto is this Uddhava Gita. And they're very important instructions because they were instructions given by Krishna just before his departure. And there's many parallels or similarities our acharyas explain between the Uddhava Gita and the Bhagavad Gita. And of course, there are differences. The setting is very different. Krishna spoke the Uddhava Gita under the base of a tree, very peaceful setting. Of course, the imminent departure of Krishna was there, so that was looming. And Bhagavad Gita is a very different set of circumstances on the battlefield. Krishna and one of the largest battles to ever taken place. So there's also a difference in the relationship as well. Uddhava was entrusted by Krishna to give the message to the gopis that he would be returning, and he's also part of the Yadu dynasty. So essentially the teaching is the same. But Uddhava Gita, those instructions by Krishna, are elaborated upon in more depth. Now our acharyas, so specifically our Gaudiya Vaishnava acharyas, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Baladevi Devushan, they pointed out that in the Bhagavad Gita, the subject matter of bhakti is primarily in the middle of the Gita, just as it is in the Uddhava Gita. And there's a very specific reason for that. They explain that bhakti is very confidential. It is actually very dear to the Lord, the most dear to the Lord. And therefore, it's protected on both sides by jnana and karma. And it's also protected from the speculative and pretender spiritualists who want to take bhakti very cheaply, like the sahajiyas. If you read the discussions in the Uddhava Gita of Gyan, the such deep philosophical discourse about the discerning the distinction between matter and spirit, you can understand that bhakti is not something cheap. It's actually very, very, very elevated, the topic. In the Gita, the middle six chapters, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, the last verse of the ninth chapter, actually, which is exactly in the middle of the middle six chapters, of the middle of the Gita, Krishna speaks this Paribhasa Sutra, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto Madhyaji Mam Namaskuru. which he repeats again at the end. And also in the Uddhava Gita, in the beginning, we hear teachings of the Avadhut Brahman in the beginning, the futility of ritualistic activity. And at the end, you know, Advaita philosophy. But in the beginning, in the middle, Krishna explains the glories of bhakti for that reason. Actually, Krishna, before he speaks the conclusion or the essence of the Gita at the very end, he says, please hear this most confidential, this most secret of all secrets. And then he speaks these two verses, sarva dharma brityaja mamekam charanam vraja manmana bhagma bhakta. And actually Krishna does the same thing in Uddhava Gita. In the preceding chapter, a few verses before, Krishna says that please hear the secret formula of perfection of life. And then Krishna goes on to explain the glories of the association of devotees. That the association of devotees is actually the highest form of yoga. Can you imagine? The highest form of yoga is the association of devotees. That yields the highest perfection in the possible, of all possible destinations that we can aspire for through the association of devotees. And in that chapter, Krishna elaborates, he lists all the different devotees who have achieved this perfection simply through the association of devotees, including birds like Chitayu and beasts, and culminating, it's a long list of many rakshasas too, culminating with the gopis, the Raj gopis of Vrindavan. And he elaborates on the glories of the Raj gopis of Vrindavan, the glories, how absorbed they were in love for Krishna. So, as we've been saying, today is the appearance of Radha-kun and Shyama-kun on today, Bahudashtami. In our acharyas, for example, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in Raja Riti Chintamani, they describe Radha-kund in terms of the significance and the mood and how it, what it means to all of us. So the descriptions are more in metaphorical terms, more in symbolic terms, in the ecstasy of the love, the prem that they have for Radha Krishna. For example, let's explain how two drops of celestial nectar dropped from Goloka to earth. And those drops represent the original prem between Radha and Krishna. And those celestial splendor of those two drops formed Radha-kun, Shyama-kun. Also the example, the description of Radharani in her love for Krishna was so overwhelming that her whole body melted out of love. And that body became the waters, the ambrosial waters of Radha-kun. And it's the same for Krishna. It's described that the tears of Radharani and Krishna form Radha-kun and Shyama-kun. Krishna was just steeped in such intense devotion and love for Radharani. Just completely absorbed in love for Srimati Radharani. And that the flame of that love just increasing and increasing and increasing and increasing until that empathy reached such a zenith, such a climax, where Krishna's form actually was transformed into Radharani's form. His complexion was transformed into Radharani's complexion. And he stood up in a mindless fit of insanity, running out in the force of Raj, in the form of Radharani, calling out his own name, Krishna, Krishna, where are you? Krishna, Krishna, where are you? And then Radharani saw Krishna in her form, calling out his own name. And she, the flames of his love was stoking the flames of her love, and she started empathizing with Krishna and to such a degree that her features turned into Krishna's features. Her complexion turned into Krishna's complexion. And she started calling out her own name. Hey Radhe, Hey Radhe, Hey Radhe, Hey Radhe, running into the forest. And ultimately they were able to regain their original forms by bathing in the water of their own tears. And Radharani assumed her original form of Radharani, and Krishna assumed his own form of Krishna. Now, Krishna, in that chapter where he glorifies the penultimate position of the gopis, he specifically points out that the gopis had nothing to do with any inferior forms of yoga. They didn't care anything about, of course, ritualistic activities, jnana yoga, tapa yoga, tapasya, meditation, ashtanga yoga. They just gave it no attention whatsoever. It was completely meaningless to them. What is this? Their whole life was bhakti, it was love for Krishna. But what's really fascinating is immediately after that, making a few verses later in the next chapter, we hear the instructions of the Hamsa Avatar, where Krishna is explaining in minute detail, in such deep philosophical discourse, the principles of Jnana Yoga. So how do we reconcile this transition from the futility to the emphasis of jnana? So it's not that jnana yoga has no purpose, or there's no results to jnana yoga. It's just that the gopis, they automatically were awarded the results of jnana yoga without any extraneous effort. And what is that result? That result is essentially detachment. That is the fruit of jnana, it's detachment. We have our two core principles: always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. That's what we're supposed to be living our life by. So what is Jnana Yoga? Is simply the converse of those two statements. Always remember Krishna. So never remember those things that take us away from Krishna. That's the converse. And never forget Krishna. The converse is always forget those things that take us away from Krishna. So Jnana Yoga is just the converse of those two statements. In the Uddhava Gita and also Bhagavad Gita, there's so much discussion about how the mind is pulled to the sense objects, that we must control the mind by austerity and bring the mind back by that austerity, the tapa. And here we're talking about how the material intelligence is absorbed in these three phases of material intelligence, of wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. So the intelligence, the material intelligence, is captivated by these three types of realities that we experience. And ultimately, the most subtle of all is the false ego. The false ego is that hard knot in the heart that is the whole reason why we can even live in this material world. It is this conception of I and mine. Aham mamayati. And that conception is the foundation upon which we can actually exist in this material world. But that false ego can only be cut by bhakti. There's no other way to cut that false ego. It's not to denounce the merit of Jnana Yoga. The goal of detachment is not a minor thing. It is a huge undertaking to detach from this world. Our acharyas explain in the Bhagavad Gita that in this process, in this transmigration, reincarnation, every few years we're taking on a new material body. You know, we're, you know, an insect or a plant, a different kind of plant, different species of plants and insects and microorganisms. I mean, every few years we're taking on a new material body. You know, millions and millions and billions and trillions of times. So it's not that big of a deal to change this body. But our acharyas explain that our subtle body, this mind, and this false ego, we've been carrying since time immemorial. We don't change our subtle body when we change it. And just think about how attached we are to this material body. I mean, that attachment is really intense. Really intense. But we've just had this body for a few years. The subtle body we've had for millennia, millions and trillions of years. Just imagine how attached we are to the subtle body, to the mind, to the false ego. To such an extent, we have no conception of who we are beyond the mind and beyond the false ego. So it's no trivial matter to detach ourselves from the subtle body. So what is the opposite of the false ego? First of all, let's try to understand the nature of the false ego. The false ego is the concept of I and mine, right? It's I deserve the best of everything because I'm great. And I don't deserve to suffer because I'm so righteous, I'm so good, right? That's the false ego. So what's the opposite of that? The opposite of that is, Krishna, you've given me unlimited gifts and I deserve nothing. Krishna, you've given me a small particle of one particle of suffering when I deserve unlimited suffering. That spirit of gratitude, the more we can get absorbed in gratitude, then we know for certain that that bondage of false ego is gradually loosening. It's loosening, loosening. And actually, it is through gratitude that we can actually, like, realize that we have needs, right? That we, Krishna, I don't have anything. I'm nothing without you. Please give me your mercy. Please give me your love. Please help me. Please guide me. But if we're thinking that, you know, I got my affairs taken care of, I got it all organized, you know, I've got my plans, you know, things are going my way. Of course it's going my way because everything's mine, right? Everything. So we don't connect to that, the need, the core need of the Atma, because we're just so complacent. And it's in that dependence, that gratefulness gives that sense that we're dependent on you, Krishna. We need you. We need each other. We can't live without you. Help! And we can cry out the holy name, like Srila Prabhupada says, like the baby for its mother. Cry out the holy name. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, maybe we can try to narrate some of the details of the pastime of Radha Kund for our own purification. So we actually heard the story before the class even started, but we can speak it again. It can only benefit all of us. The Keshi demon was spying on Krishna, because, you know, this is the person that's killing all of the demons sent by Kamsa. So one day, he notices Radharani. He's like, wow, who is that? So he explained to Kamsa, you know, I found, you know, this unbelievable person, Radharani. And he immediately decided, I'm going to abduct her. I want her. So Arishtasura told Kamsa, advised him to send Sankachuda. Of course, Sankachuda was sent to the abode of Yamaraj. And then Arishtasura was sent. And when Arishtasura came, now Arishtasura was pretty amazing. It said that Arishtasura was so fear-provoking that he just playfully shook his head, and Lord Shiva was afraid of his bull carrier Nandi, and he hid him in a cave in the Mandara mountain. This is how powerful Arishtasura was. Just that playful shaking of the head. So he came during dusk on the outskirts of Nandagram, and at that time Krishna and the gopis were about to have a rasa dance, but they all, and the acharyas say that Vishakha at that time was actually a little bit angry with Krishna, but she forgot her anger and she hid behind, and all the gopis hid behind Krishna, and they sent him out saying, go figure out what that sound is, because I heard the sound. So Krishna went out, and he went to the pastures, and he saw this gigantic bull, black bull, with this mountainous hump, and this tail was shooting up in the sky, and kind of twirling, like in the clouds were twirling around the tail, and it was actually creating a storm just by the tail going like that. And all the animals and the cows, especially the cows and the bulls, they were terrified. They're running into the barns, and all the cowherd boys and girls and men and women, they were trembling, you know, hearing the sounds of Arishtasura. And there were a few brave gopas that said, okay, let me protect, you know, the Brajvasis. And they tried to face Arishtasura, but as soon as Arishtasura charged at them, like, you know, 1 millimeter, they just like, they started running away. And so then Krishna, he looked at the Brajvasis and says, don't worry, nothing to be afraid about. And he looks to Arishtasura and he says, who are you? How dare you frighten my Brajvasis? How could you do this, you despicable scum? And that, of course, that her sister wasn't too happy about that. But to make matters worse, Krishna, you know, he's tightened his sash, and the acharyas explained that he kind of slapped his arms like that. And then just to make it just the last kind of, you know, insult, we just kind of casually flung his arm around Subala's shoulder, saying, come on, well, you know, like one of those. So then Urshasura got really, man, he was angry. So he went full speed ahead, charging, and, you know, fire shooting out of his nostrils, you know, million miles an hour. His horns were pointed down, and, you know, he was wrecking fences and digging holes into the ground. I mean, it was, and his hooves were like digging like huge holes in the ground. I mean, it was not a pretty sight at all. And he went charging to Krishna. Of course, we all know Krishna just took him by the horns and threw him down. And he charged him again, and he threw him down again, and he took out his horn and started beating him. And he was just turning into a bloody mess and passing stool and urine. And finally, actually, the acharyas explain that because he was in the bull body, Krishna didn't kill him. Yamaraj came down and killed him for him. But no one saw that. And Radharani didn't see that either, apparently. So after this pastime, the Brijbasis were just in total delight. They were just beyond like in ecstasy, and they just wanted to spend the whole night celebrating. Krishna killed the Urshasura, Krishna killed the whole night. They just celebrated, but Krishna wasn't that happy, because what happened? He missed his nocturnal pastimes. He missed his rasa dance. He wasn't happy about that at all. Brijbasis were happy, but he wasn't happy. So the next day, he said, okay, he came back to that same area, Vrindavan, where Urshasura was slain, and said, hey gopis, let's finish where we left off yesterday. We were just about to have the rasa dance, and all the gopis cheered, hey, whoa, yeah! And then Radharani, of course, and Krishna reached for her a little bit, and she said, don't touch me, you bull killer. And Krishna said, you foolish woman, what are you talking about? That wasn't a bull, that was a demon in the guise of a bull. That wasn't a bull at all. And he reached for her again. And this time, she slapped his hand. And he's like, wow, she's upset. Krishna said, so what do you want me to do? He said, you need to atone for your sin, just like Indra atoned for his sin when he killed Vritrasura. It's interesting, though. When Indra killed Vritrasura, Vritrasura was already dead. You know, after you die, you have rigor mortis. You're so stiff, right? The body becomes like really stiff. That's why it took Indra a whole year, right, to cut off his head, because he was already dead. So in the same way, Krishna actually never killed Urshasura. Yamaraj killed him. So it was decided that he would bathe in all the holy places, in all the three worlds. But Krishna said, I don't want to waste my time going all over the place, because I want to have my rasa dance. So I'm going to bring all the holy places here. So that's what he did. He kicked the ground with his heel, and all the holy places came. But the gopis, when they saw that, they weren't really impressed, because from their point of view, it just looked like trickles of water, you know, going in like that. And so Radharani said, she started laughing. She's like, you call that, like, bathing in the holy places? She said, where are the presiding deities? If they're out here, where are the presiding deities? So then Krishna said, he was very confident. And immediately all the presiding deities came. And they appeared there along with their waters. And of course, Krishna, he took his ritual bath, and he was feeling really good about it, because all the presiding deities were there chanting Purusha Shuktam, and he was taking his bath, and he was, you know, really liking it, you know. And he came out with this garland of lotus flowers, and he approached Radharani really arrogantly, saying, "Have you ever done anything like that before?" And so she said in a very loud voice, she said, "I am going to create a kund that's far superior to your puny kund, Shyama kund." So she decided to create Radha kund. So it's getting late. So really quickly, they were dugging. She decided that where Arishtasura or one of his hoof prints were, to make that into Radha kund. So all the gopis started digging, and they used their hands and they used their bangles in every way, but actually a really nice kund was formed. And then Krishna again, he tried to, you know, show his arrogance a little bit, saying, "Oh, why don't you use my waters to fill your kund?" And she would not have any of that. So they decided to bring the waters of the Manasaganga to her kund, and they did. But Krishna realized that humility was the only answer to conquer Radharani's heart in this situation. So he called an envoy of all of the presiding deities of the waters to come out and to approach Radharani, saying that, "You are so amazing, Radharani. You are the greatest of the great. You're so great that Krishna wipes the perspiration off your face, that he makes color markings on your feet. He's like your indentured servant. I just have one desire." Of course, Radharani was a little pleased by that. You know, of course, Krishna didn't say that, but he was Krishna's messenger. And she looked at, you know, her gopis, she looked at Krishna for some cues. She says, "Okay, well, what's your desire?" "My desire, with tears in his eyes, is that you kindly accept the water, our waters." And that's when the waters from Shyama kund went into Radha kund. And actually, that canal that was formed between Shyama kund and Radha kund, that represents one of the yoga peats on Vrajbhumi. There's different yoga peats where the eternal associates of Raj, they meet to perform their pastimes. And that was one of those during his midday pastimes. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Chaitanya Sikshamrita mentions that the killing of Arishtasura represents the attraction to the splendor, the pomp, and the splendor of religion. So misidentifying true spirituality with material things, like their opulences and things like that. And that attraction, that tendency to do that, is actually represented in Arishtasura. And when Krishna killed that demon, Arishtasura, means we need to kill that weed in our heart, that to mistake spiritual advancements by opulences, material opulences. And in Chaitanya Lila, Lord Chaitanya makes this amply clear just in his Lila, in his example. Haridas Thakur was a lecha, he was an outcast, he was a Namacharya, right? The Goswamis of Vrindavan, the Sambandha Acharya, the Abhideya Acharya, Rupinsanatha Goswami, they were shunned by Hindu society. Ramananda Rai, most intimate associate of Lord Chaitanya, was a Shudra. So he's making a message. He's making a message. Just from an economic point of view, Kulavicha Sridhar, you can't get much poorer than Kulavicha Sridhar, right? Spirituality has nothing to do with how much money you have, apparently. Lord Chaitanya would spend 2 hours arguing with Kulavicha. He spent 2 hours of his time arguing with Kulavicha Sridhar for his banana leaves. Just imagine how dear he was to Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya, in the South Indian tour, he spent 4 months staying with an illiterate person. He couldn't even read. Right? He was reading the Bhagavad Gita. He's trying to read the Bhagavad Gita. He spent 4 months with him. So the message is that Queen Kunti says, Jain Maishwarya Sutta Sribhya Idaman Madhapaman, that these are all disqualifications. High birth, parentage, learning, wealth, all these things, all these opulences, they're disqualifications on the path of bhakti. The only qualification is gratitude, humility, surrender. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Would anyone like to say anything? Remove this one. Hand in the back. Yes.
This has something to do with class, fortunately. But Aristasura, right? Aristasura. So if it wasn't for Krishna, I mean, this guy's a terrorist, right? He would have killed 50, 100, couple hundred kids. And he didn't, Krishna stopped him, but this probably wasn't the first time he thought of trying to do something like that. He might have done it before. And yet, every day, there was another personality, and this is Treta Yuga coming, trying to pull a stunt like that, which suggests in Treta Yuga, you know, they had a lot of headline news events, perhaps. You know, only Krishna stopped it in his pastime. So why would someone be surprised when that happens in our times, when it seems like it's a daily event in Treta Yuga?
It's actually Dwapar Yuga. It's Treta Yuga and Dwapar
Yuga. Dwapar Yuga, Treta Yuga. It's one of the other yugas, which is supposed to be so much more of a hop, skip, and a jump.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, you know, whoever you are, life isn't easy. Even the gopis, you know, they went every day, every moment. It was like pure agony when they were away from Krishna. It's intense suffering, you know. Love is not easy. Love is not easy. The path of bhakti is not easy. And even in the spiritual world, it's not all fun and games, you know. There's a lot of pain and suffering, you know. But that pain and suffering, of course, we know is Ladini Shakti. Another point to mention is those demons aren't ordinary, though. They're in Garga Samhita and other scriptures, it explains that each one of them, they have a very significant past in history. Thank you, Prabhu. Very good point.
We have some pretty strong demons in Kali Yuga, too. Prabhu, there are many stories how Radhakund and Shyamakund came around. These are in different eras, I mean, different times. Like you said, from the tears of Krishna and Radha, Shyamakund and Radhakund were created.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Aristasura. So are these happen at different times? I mean, are different appearances of Radhakund and Shyamakund?
So in Rajariti Chintamani by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he gives these descriptions of the appearance of Radhakund. But it's coming from his own ecstasy. So Krishna can perform pastimes that are unique, right, to you, that me and you may not be, you know, like Krishna may have his own pastime with you, right, that I don't know about. Krishna is unlimited. So these pastimes are, they represent the ecstasy of our acharyas and their appreciation and significance of Radhakund. Does that make sense? In Vishnu, in the prayers, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he actually uses the word "I think." He says, "I think that these waters are like the melted forms of Krishna and Radha." So it's very personal. It's a very personal expression, metaphorical understanding of the meaning and significance of Radha. I'm not saying it's not. It's not. Like, there's, you know, prakata and aprakata, manifest and unmanifest. It's an unmanifest glory of Radhakund that's appearing in the heart of, you know, great acharya. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, they're actually, I mean, like, Krishna did kill the demon Arishasura.
Mm.
So, I mean, there are incidents, you know, many of demons that these things happen. Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking when I was in India that they resurrected Radha Kund because it was there, and when the six Goswamis were there, it was also very hidden.
That's right.
And then they,
that's right.
They went, they brought them back. Mm-hmm. The same thing, they, when they cleaned Radha Kund out, you know, again, lots of people were not going because it was, you know, in a bad shape, but after it was clean again, everybody was talking about Radha Kund, Radha Kund. So I was just wondering how these.
Actually, Rupa Goswami in Upadeshamrita, he explains the process to actually see Radha Kund. Radha Kund isn't a matter of getting on a plane and going to a physical location. You know, entering into Radha Kund is, there's adhikar, there's certain qualifications that are required. And the conclusion of the Upadeshamrita is Radha Kund, right? There's the three last three verses are a glorification of Radha Kund. But how does he begin? We must tolerate the urges of the tongue, the belly. That's how it begins. And our acharyas explained that in order to actually visit Radha Kund, we must have loving relationships with other devotees. It's not possible to enter Radha Kund without loving relationships with the devotees. So, you know, an imposter, you know, who's kind of like not really loving to devotees, goes to Radha Kund and pretends to be a Babaji and chants Hare Krishna all day. You can identify who are the pretenders, who are the imposters, and who are the true, you know, Basis, you know, who are the true residents of Radha Kund. Because Rupa Goswami explains that in Upadeshamrita, that the adhikar is loving relationships with other devotees, the six loving exchanges. That's a prerequisite. So Radha Kund is not just a physical place that we see it with these eyes, which it is, yeah. You inspired me to talk about that. Thank you.
Prabhupada, when the devotees were playing in the water, he also had, you know, had special, you know, special way to approach water.
Yeah.
So that's it too.
Thank you, Mataji.
The protecting bhakti by the first part of Gita, both Uddhava Gita and Bhagavad Gita, with the karma and jnana and then jnana. So, on a practical level, I mean, I've heard this many times, on a practical level, how does it actually work that bhakti is protected when people get entangled in like the yoga ladder? And I've never really heard that explanation. I've heard this explanation of how it's protected, but how does it actually protect it?
So there's a huge difference between sahajiyas and true practitioners of bhakti, right? Huge difference. When we understand the principles of detachment and renunciation, see, bhakti is not a separate path. Bhakti includes everything. So you can't practice bhakti and not be detached. If you're attached to this material world, you can't practice bhakti properly. Does that make sense? So it protects it. It protects the true essence of what bhakti really is from pretenders who says bhakti is something cheap. Just like the sahajas do, right? They dress in saris and they have relationships with women saying, we're doing our own rasa dance, right? There's a huge difference, right, between our acharyas, our Gaudiya Vaishnava acharyas, and the sahajas. So that jnana and that karma, there's so much descriptions in the Gita that explains such philosophical detail to communicate the message that bhakti isn't cheap. It's actually very deep. It's actually very deep. It includes those paths. Does that answer your question?
And then, I tend to think in like maybe more of mechanistic way.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, so you got the first six sure. and the last six.
Right.
And then, but usually people read books from the beginning to the end.
Right. No, that's the Gita is meant to be read from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But before Krishna talks about bhakti, he talks about, you know, we're not these bodies, right?
Yeah.
That's important. Yeah. That's a prerequisite. And then after he talks about bhakti, then he reinforces that, saying that, you remember that, you know, we're not these bodies. He says it again.
Okay, I think that makes sense.
So maybe we should end because it's getting late. Sorry, thank you. Gandharva Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Radha Kunda ki, Shyama Kunda ki.